From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. A shout out this Friday the 13th to Coast listener and friend of the show, John Nieto. Appreciate you listening, John. Later tonight, Friday the 13th, open lines and the debut of the guy from Pittsburgh. Get ready for that. The Food and Drug Administration has issued a stronger warning now that a common sweetener in chewing gum, mints, and other products could kill or severely poison dogs. The warning comes on the heels of a surge in deaths and severe illnesses from dogs accidentally ingesting the sweetener xylitol. According to the Pet Poison Control Centers, the FDA warning, xylitol in your dog, was issued by the agency as a consumer update. Now, a prior FDA warning issued back 5 years ago by the agency's Center for Veterinary Medicine briefly warned of potential illness in dogs eating xylitol. So please be careful. You never know. Russian President Vladimir Putin has described the development of NATO's U.S.-led missile defense program as a threat to global security, and he has vowed that Russia will take the necessary steps to maintain a strategic parity. Putin, speaking at a meeting with military officials, scoffed at U.S. claims that the shield isn't aimed at Russia, but instead intended to fend off a missile threat from Iran. The system includes a site in Romania that became operational just a few days ago. An Islamic State fighter captured in Iraq last week reportedly begged Kurdish troops to kill him right away because he didn't want to be late for a 4 p.m. religious ceremony in heaven. Kurdish forces captured the militant after he and 49 others were sent out by ISIS for a suicide bombing attack in a Christian town. He was wounded. No word on what happened to him. The Department of Homeland Security will immediately increase the use of overtime and work to quickly bring in more screening officers to help alleviate long lines at airport security checkpoints. But they warn that the wait times are still inevitable during the busy summer travel season. More than 3,000 checked bags missing their outbound flights in Phoenix, all because of a problem with the screening system at the Sky Harbor International Airport. What a mess that was. And prosecutors say a Delta Airlines flight attendant has been charged with stealing nearly 1,500 mini bottles of liquor from her job on the plane and selling them online. Former President Bill Clinton was a much more frequent flyer on a registered sex offender's infamous jet than previously reported, with flight logs showing the former president taking at least 26 trips aboard the Loyota Express, apparently ditching even his Secret Service detail for at least five of those flights. Clinton's presence aboard Jeffrey Epstein's Boeing 727 on 11 occasions has been reported, but flight logs show the number is more than double that between 2001 and 2003. Epstein, who counts among his pals royal figures, heads of state, celebrities, and fellow billionaires, spent 13 months in prison and home detention for solicitation and procurement of minors for prostitution, taking friends to what he called Orgy Island. It's his 72-acre estate in the Virgin Islands. Jeez. And Bill Clinton's foundation apparently arranged a $2 million pledge to a power company partly owned by a wealthy divorcee, who some say is the frequent visitor to his home, nicknamed Energizer. Dr. Jerome Corsi, of course, who writes for WND, is working on an expose on the Clinton Foundation. Jerry, does this story add any more credence to what you're doing?
It's more of the same, George. It's a private company. The company was Energy Pioneer Solutions, which was supposed to be doing home insulation for green energy projects. And this Julie Tabor McMahon, who is reportedly one of the paramours of Bill Clinton, is a major owner of the company. And the Clinton Foundation arranged for it to have either a charitable gift or an investment. It's not clear from a Kim Samuel, who owns a group of companies involved in steel. Now, the story broke in the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday, and then it got picked up by the New York Post, and the connection between this woman, this Julie Tabor McMahon, was identified in a 2014 book by Ronald Kessler, The First Family, as her Secret Service code name, apparently the Energizer, was a frequent guest in Bill Clinton's Chappaqua home when Hillary wasn't there. She was secreted in and secreted out by the Secret Service to avoid being seen by Hillary, evidently. And the scandal is that a Clinton Foundation, this whole Clinton Global Initiative, as a charitable entity under federal tax laws, should not be, very suspect, to be investing in a private company.
That's right.
That personal friends of Bill Clinton, including possibly lovers, you know, have an interest in. The whole thing looks like it's a using of the tax laws to benefit private enterprise that benefits friends of Bill Clinton, including potentially this woman lover. So the story becomes salacious, and it becomes a major headline, and has kind of swept the news in the last two or three days. And from the research I've been doing in a book called coming out called Clinton, you know, Partners in Crime, I'm alleging, and as do others, that the Clinton Foundation is really a criminal enterprise that is designed to enrich the Clintons and their friends, and is not a true charity. When you really examine its reporting, how it has used tax laws, how it has benefited friends, how it has favored getting deals out of the State Department when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, I think this is going to become a major campaign issue as the presidential election develops through the summer.
When do you expect your work to get done?
My book will be out on July 12th. It's Partners in Crime. It's already up at Amazon.com.
Okay.
And thank you, George, but I expect that we're going to be hearing a lot more about the Clinton Foundation and activities like this violating potentially charitable laws.
Okay, Jerry, have yourself a good weekend. Thank you for that report. An Illinois woman accused of giving her severely disabled daughter a fatal dose of meds last year before trying to kill herself stood before a Cook County judge explaining that her love for her daughter was so strong that killing her seemed to be the most humane thing to do. She wanted her daughter to be in heaven with her. Jake Booth is an Army veteran and a former sheriff's deputy from Collier County, Florida. He's also the survivor of a 48-day coma. And on the day he miraculously woke up, the man had one thing on his mind. What do you think that was? Taco Bell tacos. He wanted one so badly, and thanks to a lot of therapy and great medical treatment for him, Booth got his wish. And about a month later, he got to chow down on 8 Taco Bell tacos. There's a commercial there, I'm telling you. Up next, let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do you got for us?
Good evening, George, and greetings from McMinnville, Oregon, which is...
Oh, you're there! Great.
I'm here and have my presentation tomorrow morning at 10, and many, many greetings from the audience to you and Tom.
Super.
I remember your presence up here 2 years ago, I think it was. But, boy, a lot's going on. I'm away from the center, but brought a few very, very interesting reports with me. I'd like to start, though, with just a short shout-out to Jay up in Butte, Montana, who's been so terribly helpful to the National UFO Reporting Center. He's done a great job, and I'm really indebted to the gentleman. He'll recognize his name. He's a regular listener, George. But 4 quick reports, really, really interesting reports. One goes back to last week, a report that I didn't have time to report. I had it in the stack, but I was running out of time. Woodbury, Minnesota, the 5th of May, I think that was a Thursday, so this is 8 days ago. A gentleman who describes himself as a federal employee with a great deal of responsibility was walking at 2 p.m. that Thursday afternoon in Woodbury, Minnesota, and he was mystified to see a shadow move across the ground. He was confused because it was a clear sky out, looked up, there was nothing up there. It moved off at, he estimates, about 15 miles an hour. There was one right behind it. Both of these about 1 foot by 2 foot in dimension. Again, moving at about the same pace as a brisk bicycle rider. He stood there and watched 30 of them, George. There was nothing, absolutely nothing above him in a clear blue sky. Have no idea what those objects were, but very, very interesting story. The next day, second report, this is an interesting one, from Lake Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. That's about 20, 25 miles east of Spokane, Washington, not too far from where the UFO Center is. Husband and wife were sailing on Lake Coeur d'Alene, and at 9 o'clock that Friday night, this is a week ago now, approximately, they moored their boat to a buoy in Beauty Bay, which is in the northeast corner of Lake Coeur d'Alene. They were sound asleep. At 10:26, they were awakened by the boat rocking rather severely, so much so that they thought they had been caught in a storm cell. And at the same time that was happening, they had some very bright light streaming below decks into their cabin. Well, the wife requested that her husband take the flashlight and some kind of defensive weapon, go up on deck and find out what was going on. He went up there, and he found a very brightly lighted object up in the night sky. It was projecting a column of light, both husband and wife report in their respective reports, a column of light that was orbiting their sailboat and roiling the waters. The light suddenly snapped off. The husband could see the object. It suddenly shot off in the night sky to the southwest. Really a very interesting report. And both of those reports posted to our website. Just a comment on this case, George, because of your background in the Navy, I don't know who was skippering that boat, husband or wife, but I think if I had awakened on that boat and thought there was an intruder on the upper deck, I would have pointed out to my wife that it was not the responsibility of the skipper so much as the member of the crew to repel that boarding party. Again, I don't know who was skippering the boat, but I'm going to leave that one to you, given your background in the Navy.
You got it.
The next afternoon, this again is on the 7th of May, a woman experienced in Telluride, Colorado, western Colorado, 40-year-old woman with a 4-year-old daughter, experienced something similar to what these two sailors had experienced in her bedroom. Flickering light that was pulsing 3 seconds on, 8 seconds off. She looked out, saw a very bright object up in the night sky. Whether these two cases are related or not, I have no idea. And finally, last case, on the evening of the 7th of May, this is last Saturday, a husband and wife were driving in McQuaidie, Kentucky, and as they drove on Highway 261 near McQuaidie, a sphere, a transparent sphere of light with a pink center just streaked across the sky, probably not 40 feet off the ground from their right to left, and continued in a straight line, disappeared from their sight. So lots going on, and I invite members of the coast-to-coast audience to report these things if they see them. We doubt that we're getting more than one out of 20,000 sightings, George, so I encourage people, if they see something unusual, to please get in touch.
UFOCenter.com. Peter, thanks. Enjoy your event out there. Up next, we're going to dabble with the paranormal on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're going to have a couple hours of some interesting paranormal. Phasma, which happens to be Latin for ghost, Phasma Paranormal, founded in the spring of 2010 by the husband and wife team of Michael and Kelly Lee Broski. Now, the Phasma Paranormal is dedicated to research, history, investigating, and documenting of supernatural events, and they are a professional paranormal research team with a deep respect for the history and reverence for those that have gone before us. and they will continue to investigate. Kelly Lee and Michael Broski on Coast to Coast. Hello, you two. How are you?
Good. How are you?
How you doing, Mr. Norr?
Looking forward to this. This is it's fun, but it's also fascinating for me. Tell me, if you would, Kelly, let's start with you. How did you and Michael get involved in this?
It's a funny story, actually. We used to love to watch the paranormal shows on television. And, you know, we figured if they could do it, we could certainly do it ourselves. So we decided one day we took our, just a cheap recorder and a cheap, you know, camera, and we went to a local cemetery that we had read online was haunted. We walked around the cemetery and did some, you know, questions, kind of feeling stupid. We got home. We got our very first EVP, and we were actually able to confirm with a lady that I worked with that was her grandfather.
Wow.
And he did die the way he said he did in the EVP.
Michael, did that shock you?
Yeah, it sure did. I consider myself, you know, I try to maintain a little healthy skepticism in this business, and that really did shock me. I was cutting grass, and she came out and got me, and I kind of came running in, and I was just shocked to hear it. But the relevance of it was definitely confirmed.
So when you started doing this, I mean, did you then just jump right into these kinds of investigations?
Yes, after we got that first result, because truthfully, when we started, we really didn't believe what we were seeing. We're like, that can't be true. We have to go see for ourselves. So after we got that first one, you know, it kind of inspired us to go do some more, and we kept getting amazing results. So it's just kind of spurred us on and on and on, and we've been doing it now for, you know, over 500-600 investigations.
Wow, that's a lot. Now, you're in the South Carolina area, right?
Yes, sir. We're right near Myrtle Beach.
That is a generally pretty haunted area, isn't it?
Extremely. I mean, we have Revolutionary War, Civil War. We're within driving distance of Wilmington, Charleston, Savannah, Columbia. I mean, we can hit all kinds of battlefields and graveyards and World War II vessels and all kinds of cool stuff.
And Michael, has your team grown, or is it just you and Kelly?
We're unique in the fact that it's just the two of us, and we like it that way. We handle all the equipment, all the evidence review. It's just us, and it's a lot easier when we're reviewing EVPs and we know each other, and we're just in sync when we go on these investigations.
What has been, for both of you, your most memorable investigation beyond the initial one which got you into this?
Well, for me, I think it has to be the Old City Jail in Charleston, South Carolina.
Uh-huh. Tell me about that, Kelly.
Well, the first time we were there, we did a four-hour lockdown investigation, and we actually witnessed a door not only close by itself, but also open by itself. And that was probably, to the point, the most overt sign of paranormal activity we'd seen.
And, of course, there were some deaths in that area, right?
Tons, about 14,000.
Oh, my gosh, 14,000?
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. Michael, how about you, your most memorable investigation?
We were on a Revolutionary War battlefield, the Battle of Camden. Unfortunately, it was a Patriot loss, but we were walking around. It's a largely undeveloped area because it was a Patriot loss, but there's some nice trails in there, and we were running some recorders, and we asked some standard questions, and one of the questions I asked was, who was your commanding officer? Well, I came back, and I was reviewing, and I heard Malcolm, and I thought, that's a strange name. Well, I went on the search engines on the computer, and sure enough, Lord Cornwallis had in his death records a British casualty, Captain Malcolm, and that was just stunning for me. That really sold me on it.
Now, have you ever had an entity attach themselves to either one of you?
I don't know if attach themselves is necessarily what's happened to us, but we have been followed home on multiple occasions. One of them was almost the last time we ever did it.
Oh, really?
It was probably our fourth or fifth investigation. We had been at a tiny rural cemetery, and when I say tiny, there was probably no more than six, 7 grades. From the moment we got there, I didn't feel right. I was very uncomfortable. We stayed less than 5 minutes.
All right, stay with us, you two. We're going to come back and talk more with you, Kelly Lee, Michael Broski, as we talk about their paranormal group, a group of two. We'll be back. Okay, welcome back to Coast, two special guests for you tonight, Kelly Lee and Michael Broski, as we talk about their work in the paranormal world. How did you come up with the name Phasma?
Well, we originally started with Veritas Paranormal, but we realized very quickly that there were several other groups with that name, and we wanted something special, and I took a lot of Latin in high school, so we kind of came up with that name.
I like it. It's kind of memorable.
Yes, that's why we like it.
So now let's talk about how you plan out your events. How often do you go out and investigate, and where do you find the sites?
Well, you know, a lot of times people call us either homeowners or businesses, renters, that sort of thing, to tell us there's something going on in their location. And we kind of speak with the clients and determine exactly what's going on and exactly what they expect from us. And then, you know, we act accordingly, sometimes going out to investigate. Other times it's a matter of just sending them blessed metals or prayers or just talking them through what to do.
Michael, have you and Kelly ever been in a very dangerous situation because of this?
It's kind of funny. We always say that we're more afraid of the living than we are the dead.
That's probably true.
Yes, sir. We do a lot of our investigating during the day, and I know that's unusual for a lot of paranormal groups, but our theory is if it's haunted at night, it's also haunted during the day. And, you know, we have a very strict code about trespassing. And when you go out at night, that brings a whole other aspect to it, to some of these cemeteries. You know, you worry about crime and animals. And but stumbling around on the battleship North Carolina, yeah, that could be a little dangerous if you don't watch your footing when you're in the complete darkness.
Oh, that's true. Now, do you two have children at all?
We have a 25-year-old daughter that's going to be 26 soon.
You're kidding. Kelly, you sounded 26. That's amazing.
Oh, thank you. So, not quite, but I appreciate that.
What does she think of this?
I think she's terrified. She doesn't really want to do it with us because she's too scared of, I think, what she might find.
When she was a little girl, did you bring her into this field, this arena?
No. We wouldn't have done this if we'd had a small child at the house. It's too dangerous.
And kind of scary for them, I would guess.
Yeah, and you just not knowing what's going to come home with you. You can't subject a small child to that. They're so much more vulnerable.
Michael, tell me, and I'll get to you on this too, Kelly. Michael, what you think this is all about? What is this other side that obviously is there, but what is it? Why is it?
That's a good question, and that's part of our ongoing quest is we're trying to figure out just exactly what the heck's going on here. Are they spirits that are trapped? Sometimes we get the impression from some of our EVPs that some of them don't even realize they've passed on. Are we dealing with another dimension and we're rubbing up against it? We're catching glimpses of this other parallel universe or whatever it is. We're just not sure. You know, it's part of what we're trying to find out.
Well, I hope you get to the bottom of it. What kind of equipment, Michael, do you use?
Oh, we have a wide variety. We have full-spectrum cameras. We have a FLIR for the heat-sensitive. We've got we use EM pumps. We have some of the ITC, the Ovulus, the Melmeter.
Wow.
We use a wide variety of equipment.
Well, these ghosts, they're probably just nothing but energy and probably easy to capture if you have the right gear.
No, they're very difficult to
capture.
Are
they? How come?
We have, you know, at any given location, we might go out and we might take 500, 600, 700 photos. I mean, we take hours worth of video. We start our audio recordings from the moment we get on location till the moment we leave. And there's been locations we've been to where we've got absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all. And Kelly, let me ask you the same question I asked Michael. What do you think this is all about?
Well, you know, I consulted with a priest when we started this because we were concerned. We didn't want to do anything wrong. And he told me that heaven isn't forced on anyone. So just because you can go doesn't mean that you do go. So I think these spirits are people that are trapped here for whatever reason, whether they're attached to a person, place, or thing.
Do you believe in reincarnation?
I haven't actually seen evidence of that, but I'm not saying I don't believe. I've learned one thing is being a paranormal investigator. There's a whole lot more out there than anyone realizes.
Michael, how about you?
I agree with her on that. I really haven't seen any evidence of that. We've met people, you know, who strongly believe in that, but I haven't seen any evidence of that. But we try to keep an open mind, and we're always willing to investigate something like that.
Do you two dabble with the Ouija board?
No.
That's smart.
No, Michael, I'll defer to you on that one.
I kind of like to use the analogy. It's like opening a door. I mean, in your house, you wouldn't leave your door open because you never know who's going to come through there. And I believe, you know, the board itself can be a portal to open up, and something naughty might come through, and you just don't want to take that chance.
So, you know, everybody wants to be a paranormal investigator. They all want to go on ghost hunts. They all, you know, some of them think it's just fun. It's not just fun, Kelly, is it?
No, and it for us, it's not just about fun. You know, we're in it really more for the spirits than anything else. We feel honored and we feel a strong calling to be able to tell their stories. Our tagline is, we believe the dead have a voice and we honor them by listening. And that's our whole thing. I mean, some of these amazing people that we've run into in these cemeteries and homes and such, you know, they're trying to say something, and we might be the only ones that can hear them.
That could be. That could be. Now, what do you plan for the future in terms of your investigating? What's your next assignment?
Well, you know, in between private locations, we go out to battlefields and cemeteries and things like that. We have a whole list of places that we're wanting to do, but this summer we will be headed down to the Castillo de San Marcos in St. Augustine, Florida.
Okay, that's going to be good.
Yes.
Now, how long will you stay down there?
We actually will be staying in a haunted inn that we've been in now for 3 years. It's a very, very active haunted inn down there, and we'll be down there for 4 or 5 days. We'll do the Castillo, we'll do the lighthouse, and then there's a very haunted antique store down there that we've had some interesting experiences in.
All right, and Michael, in terms of what you will be doing, how do you set up your gear, and what do you start looking for?
We go through a preparation before every investigation. There's the inevitable charging of all the batteries and equipment. We make sure that it's all in working order, because there's nothing more frustrating than getting out there and finding out your equipment doesn't work. So we test all that. You know, we like to do a little research on a site before we go. You know, find out how many deaths might occur there, what kind of history is there. But we also are careful not to get too much information, because we don't want that to, you know, sway our findings. Sometimes I think your mind plays tricks on you, and if you're looking for something, you know, you might end up jumping to conclusions. So we kind of like to keep ourselves a little in the dark as far as the history goes.
Have you two ever come across demons in your investigations?
Thankfully, we haven't. We did come across something in a children's cemetery that said it was the devil, and we left. We don't play with demons. We do have resources through the clergy in the event that we do come across demons, and we are part of the Paranormal Warriors of St. Michael, so we can call on a network of clergy to help us, but we don't deal with demons.
At all?
No, demons aren't. You know, your average human can't deal with a demon. A demon is a fallen angel. I mean, a regular person can't do that. It has to be a member of the clergy. Of whatever clergy you use, it has to be a member of the clergy.
Do you make recommendations to the clergy and say, hey, there's an area here that we're not going to touch?
Well, what they would want us to do is we would go in, we would collect evidence, to show them that it's a, that it is indeed something more than just a human spirit. Or, you know, you always have to rule out mental illnesses, medications. It can be a very detailed process. But once we determine that it is something a little more, then a priest would come in or a member of the clergy would come in to do whatever they need to do, and we would assist them however they needed us to.
Why do I find the ghostly spirits of children kind of eerie? I don't know why, but I always have.
Well, that's creepy to think that a small child is still hanging around. I mean, they're innocent. How could they still be there?
But they are, aren't they?
Yes, and a lot of people think that if it's a small child, it has to be a demon. And, you know, it would make sense for a demon to masquerade as something as innocent as a child. But there are spirits of children. My husband came across one in Savannah.
Tell me about that, Michael.
Yeah, she's of a very famous ghost seen there in Bonaventure Cemetery. It's just a fantastic cemetery, steeped in all kinds of history and legend. But Gracie supposedly was a young girl, and her parents were hotel owners there in Savannah, and she passed away at a very young age, and they had a sculpture done of her. It's really magnificent to see. And when we go down there, you know, it's almost like a father-daughter kind of connection. It's just something that, you know, you feel this, like you're drawn to it. So I have some very intense spirit box sessions with her, and she's answered and communicated with us in quite a relevant way.
We also ran against one in Edisto Island as well.
What kind of messages do they try to convey to you, these ghosts? What do they want you to know?
Oh, there's all kinds of things. Sometimes it doesn't make any sense. Sometimes you get weird words that just don't make any sense. But a lot of times, like one of our EVPs, we caught at the Old City Jail in Charleston, and we actually caught a female voice saying, "Husband, please let me out." And we believe that that was Lavinia Fisher, who was thought to be one of the first female serial killers in the United States.
Oh, jeez.
And her husband actually did escape and came back for her. And that's when he got caught again, and they were both ultimately executed at the jail.
Do you ever look at each other going, why are we here?
No, I think, you know, and I think my husband will agree, when we're out investigating, neither one of us feels more alive. I mean, it seems totally natural, and I think it's something that we're both called to do.
Now, do you allow people to come with you?
Very rarely. Very, very rarely. It's usually just him and me.
Do they ask sometimes?
All the time. That's the most common question.
Let's
go.
The
most common inquiry we get is, please, please, you know, let us come with you.
Michael, some of these bed and breakfast haunted areas are pretty successful. A lot of people go there, I think, partly for fun, the other part for, you know, hey, let's see what happens. What do you think of them?
I think it's a good fit. A lot of these places have a lot of history, and, you know, it's tough maintaining. We've been in quite a few, and it's sad to see, you know, how some of these places have deteriorated. So anything to generate some interest and to keep people coming in so that they keep these historical places going, I think it's a nice fit for them. And I like to see inns and places actually encourage the paranormal.
What do you think, Michael, of some of these pictures that we've all seen of what look like apparitions or ghosts hanging around places?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I think that the paranormal is very subtle. Sometimes if it looks like it's way too good to be true, it probably is. You have to question the motive of the person taking the picture. Are they trying to gain some kind of publicity or fame? Are they trying to get some kind of financial money out of it? I think from what we've seen of the paranormal, it's very subtle and it's very rare.
What do you think, Kelly?
I agree 100%. I mean, I get asked a lot to look at pictures and give my opinion. I'm always hesitant. I don't want to crush anybody. But, you know, a lot of these pictures, I'm a graphic designer. It's very easy to fake these pictures. We take great pride in the fact that we do nothing to our photos. We do not fake any evidence at all. And I welcome anybody to look at our evidence. I'd be happy to supply the original files.
What do you think orbs are, Kelly?
Well, that's six of one, half dozen of the other, as we say in South Carolina. Basically, you know, some orbs are nothing more than dust. I mean, when you're investigating in South Carolina in the summer, you're going to get moisture. Because, you know, 80, 90% humidity every day, you're going to get moisture no matter what you do. But, you know, there are some orbs that we've caught that simply defy explanation. We've had science teachers and, you know, a bunch of science people look at these photos and no one can explain to us what they are. So, I mean, how do you explain an orb that's lit from within that literally swims through the air almost like a fish?
I know. I mean, some of it could be, you know, ball lightning. That's possible.
Not in a house.
Well, sometimes they say that it can go through, like, even glass, I've heard.
I haven't heard that, but that's fascinating.
Yeah.
And spirits are energy. So, you know, you're dealing kind of with the same thing almost.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, not every orb is paranormal. It's just like, you know, not every dog is going to bite you. It's the same basic idea.
Do you think, Michael, that the spirit realm seems to be getting more and more active for some reason?
I believe it is. I think we've noticed an increase in it, and I don't know. We've talked about this, and it's interesting. We don't know if it's because of you know, all the increase in cell phones and cell phone towers and all this wireless stuff going on. I mean, we wonder whether or not that's fueling them a little bit more. If they are energy, you know, maybe there's something to that.
Well, we'll find out soon enough, aren't we? We're going to all get there in our own time.
Yes, inevitably, sir. Yes.
Would you come back, Kelly, if you had a chance?
That's a really difficult question. I don't really know. I think, you know, if I'm given the chance to move on, I think I definitely would. I mean, that's what ultimately our faith teaches us, and that's what I know my family would want for me.
Would you come back, Michael?
I would initially say no, but having said that, you know, I understand why some of these spirits would. If there's some kind of a strong emotional attachment, if there's someone you love and you haven't finished saying, I can imagine that would be very difficult to move on if there was something. Or some of these murder victims who know that there's not going to be any justice, I mean, that you'd feel very compelled to come back and try to let somebody know. So that's a tough question.
How haunted is a cemetery, Michael?
It depends on what cemetery you go to. We go in to some places and there's nothing. Other places we go in, it's just like we're bombarded with voices. You know, it depends on the history. We never know when we're walking around if there's a tragic story involved with that cemetery. So I think it all depends on which cemetery you go to.
Kelly, are these spirits hanging around their own graves?
You know, we found that not really to be the case that often. It's very rare, actually, that we find spirits who are connected. It's very exciting for us when we actually speak to someone and they give us relevant information when we're standing in front of their grave. I mean, that's probably only happened less than a handful of times in all the times we've been in hundreds of cemeteries in multiple states.
Are the older cemeteries and graves more haunted than the more modern ones or earlier or, you know, later
so.
Aged ones?
Now, I don't know. He might disagree with me, but it seems like, you know, the more historical cemeteries. But here's the thing. We tend to shy towards the more historical cemeteries. We have had experiences in some of the newer cemeteries as well.
Would you agree with that, Michael?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the older ones tend to have a lot more activity connected to them.
All right, well, stick around. We're going to come back for a final hour, and that'll include your phone calls with Kelly Lee and Michael Broski. Their website is phasmaparanormal.com. Now, it's linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. We make it easy. They're on Facebook as well. They're on Twitter. They're on YouTube under Phasma Paranormal as well. I'm George Norrie. We will be back with your calls, ghostly calls, on Coast to Coast AM.